there's two insights that we need to glean off of. We're talking industrial revolution. Now we're talking this AI revolution. What are the two things we need to focus on? The primacy of human labor over finance or productivity. That one hit me hard when I read that. I mean, what's the reason why a lot of us are using AI is we're thinking, well, we're so sick of this kind of knowledge worker age where we're sitting in our email all day and just, you know, working on things that we think don't matter. And we're thinking AI is going to be just the savior of that and make us more productive.
Right.
You know, what does more productive mean, and productive for what? And yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about. Everything attached to AI has, you know, there's two things related to it: money and efficiency.
Right.
And those are the two things that Pope Leo's calling out, saying we need to be careful.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to Knowledge Machine.
Welcome to another episode of Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. I'm Seth Payne, and I'm here with my co-nerd, Lee. Today, we're continuing with Chapter 1 of Magnifica Humanitas. Last week, we looked at the beginning of Chapter 1 and how the gospel is applied and comments on the modern world. This week and next week, we will look at the stages of development of the social doctrine of the Church. And today, we'll focus on Pope Leo XIII and Rerum Novarum to the Second Vatican Council. Next week, we're going to look at Pope John Paul II through Pope Francis, and then, as always, because Pope Leo XIV wrote Magnificat Humanitas, we'll keep looking at what he's been doing. But before we get started, I want to remind you that if you go over to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for our email list and get updates when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up recently, and any financial support you can give us would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. So, good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Seth. How are you?
Good. The summer here is winding down.
Yeah, thank goodness. It's been a long summer, even for me up here in Minnesota. I know everyone's kind of dreading the winter, but I'm like, I think I'm ready for some change.
Yes.
It's been hot and humid.
Well, and it's that time of the summer that I'm thinking I'm ready for school to start again and get back to more of a regular routine.
Routine and things like that, yeah. Yeah. Speaking of, before summer things, I didn't tell you before we hit record, but I ended up seeing the new Spider-Man a couple of days ago.
Oh, yes. Well, I did too. I saw it. I took my girls on Saturday.
All right. Well, we won't spoil it for anybody, but goodness, that movie was so good.
It was so good. Maybe in a month or so, we'll bring in some spoilers because, yes, it was great.
It was great. Well, it just reminded me too how, you know, we were talking about great power comes great responsibility with this whole, you know, AI thing and everything else. And just some of the themes in that new movie and some of the comments that that they make. Oh, I can't wait to talk about that. That was really, really good.
Well, Lee and I are going to talk about that. For now, we'll talk about that off camera, but I'm sure it will come in at some point.
Really good. Yep.
Yep. So I'm excited for this week and next week's episode because this section, this last second half of chapter one, it is such a great summary of what the Church has done in the last 135 years. With the impact of the Industrial Revolution. And you know, we talked about this last episode, that life before the Industrial Revolution is so different than it is now. And we can't even imagine. I mean, we have these images of a simpler life,
right?
But we can't imagine what life was like before the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely not. I mean, well, especially for us, because luckily you and I aren't that old. But, you know, I think we mentioned it a couple of episodes ago, just the whole, you know, even when you're talking to younger kids today, and like I talk to my kids and I say, you know, I remember when the iPhone was first invented. They're like, no way. Yeah. Like, what was life like before the iPhone? You know, and it's kind of that same sort of thing. I guess every generation sort of goes through this. Something comes along, whether it's technological or some other advancement, and there's that clean break of before and after, like we talked about. Yeah. And I think this AI thing, you know, it's really this, it's before AI and after AI. Within just the last year, people will be able to say something shifted. Like things just completely changed in the way that we yeah. work, in the way that we're approaching work and approaching, you know, the dignity of work. And that's what's really exciting about these chapters is Pope Leo kind of dives into what this all means and at what rate we're accelerating things in the name of efficiency. And right. And that's so funny because if you read Rerum Novarum, it was all about efficiency, right? For yes. the Industrial Revolution. I mean, it's you can almost literally plug in, you know, AI into Rerum Novarum, and it's almost speaking the same thing, which is yeah. crazy to think about. Like, not a lot of attitudes of society change, I guess, is yes. what I've been kind of thinking about. Is the attitudes are the same? We're always after this more production, more efficiency. Yeah. Sometimes that's tied to more money, more stuff, you know, and yeah. it's not changed a lot in the last 150 years.
And I think one thing that we're going to come back to a number of times this episode is Jesus says, the love of money is the root of all evil. I remember having many conversations and even sermons about the fact that so many people think it's money is the root of all evil. But it's the love of money that's the root of all evil.
Right.
And what's at the heart of so many conflicts is this desire for more, more resources, more power. Yeah, and I think all the way from the Industrial Revolution to artificial intelligence, we are going to see that this is at the root of so much of it.
Yep, because that turns the people that are trying to make money into monsters a lot of the yeah. times, you know, and that's yeah. something that even Pope Leo XIII was mentioning in Rerum Novarum is just the cost of pursuit of money and pursuit of production and what that does to the dignity of other people that you could be exploiting. And I know we're going to get into that in the next couple of chapters here, but one thing that struck me about chapter one, just kind of rereading it, preparing for this podcast episode is, my goodness, he packed a lot into this encyclical. Yes. I mean, yes. he packed a lot. And it isn't until you read it a little bit more slowly and more systematically like this that you're realizing sort of, goodness, he spent a lot of time, a lot of resources into this encyclical. It is quite the magnus opus, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the one last thing I want to say before we jump into the first paragraph is, I think it was about 2 years ago, I created a list of all of the encyclicals that he mentions in this section on the church's response to the role of the worker. Hmm. And he does such an amazing job, as we'll see, going through all of these and just pulling out the key message of each one. And he only gives a paragraph to each one of them. And so you can't really understand a lot of what's in them. So I still need to read them. You know, I've read Rerum Novarum, but I haven't read the other ones that have been written since then. So that is on my reading list to do.
You know, it's kind of neat too, is Laudato Si, you know, I know it got some different interpretations of it, and some mm-hmm. people were maybe not as happy with what Pope Francis was trying to say. But what this speaks to, Seth, is that people rarely ever read an encyclical all the way through.
Right.
You know, and if they took the time to read the encyclicals like, you know, Fratelli Tutti and some of these other ones that Pope Francis wrote, I think they would be really surprised at what it says and the context into which it's saying it. And that's what's really beautiful of these chapters 28 and on, is that Pope Leo is taking a lot of that information and saying, look at the context that Pope Francis was talking in. And it just kind of brings it into this new light. And it's exciting because hopefully it'll bring people back to some of these other encyclicals that were written years and years ago that I think people kind of put on the shelf, but they still right. speak life into what's going on today in society.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into the first paragraph then. Paragraph 28. Having outlined the way in which the church is present in history and engages in dialogue with the world, I would now like to consider the development of social doctrine in the magisterium, which has responded to the major social transformations from the 19th century to the present day. I would also like to stress how, within this tradition, the unchanging core of revealed truths regarding the human person and society is constantly intertwined with a renewed capacity for listening to historical situations and for responding to contemporary issues. Now, the language in here is really the language in a lot of encyclicals, and it can be kind of hard to hear and really digest. It's very churchy sounding.
Yeah.
But when I read this, basically what I see is that the teaching of the church doesn't change. The application of the teaching of the church changes because the world is always changing. That's the basic summary that I get when I read this.
Right. And I think that's a really good point, too, because when you run into comments or sentences like, I would now like to consider the development of social doctrine in the magisterium, I think a lot of people say, oh, what do you mean? Like, it just keeps changing. You're just shifting around. And it's, you know, that word development doesn't mean, you know, the creation of something necessarily new. It means it's maturing, you know, it's growing in order to, you said it perfectly, sort of the scope of it's getting bigger for the world that we're in, so it can speak to the different issues that we're seeing, but nothing's changed. It's just the context into which it's being said is like, oh, that applies to us today and not just to the Industrial Revolution. That's also to technology. Yeah.
Well, and John Henry Newman just became a doctor of the church.
I was just going to bring him up. Exactly. Yeah.
And so he has his major work was the development of doctrine.
Right.
And one of the things I appreciate in the Catholic Church is people talk about the word dogma like it's this unmovable, really in a bad way. We're going to do this whether it's right or wrong. But the thing that I really appreciate about dogma, and there aren't tons of dogmas of the church. It's not like a huge volume. There's a limited number of dogmas of the church, but those are the things that the church says, here are the things that you need to believe in. Here are the things that you need to say, okay, these are true because the church says they're true. When I was growing up as an evangelical, the highest level we had at church was doctrine. And doctrine was seen as kind of immovable. But there wasn't then the level that doctrine plays in the Catholic Church of the things that can be discussed and maybe even debated, and not saying is this right or wrong, or there's still a higher level there, but there is more flexibility in it. And we can then rest on the dogmas and then discuss the doctrines.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point of the development on the development of Christian doctrine, that pretty large essay that John Henry Newman wrote, you know, the whole beginning of that was how he was convinced as a Protestant. That was the reason why he couldn't be Catholic, because he was saying that the Catholic Church always moved on their positions. Right. You know, so the start of the whole book is like, this is kind of what convinced me not to be Catholic. And then into looking into it, it convinced me to be Catholic because of really, and it's paradox. You just reminded me of that when you were talking, it's the paradox of the thing. How can you have a dogma? You were talking the evangelical side of things and some of the doctrines that we had. How can you have a dogma or a doctrine that is, you know, this absolute truth that is quote unquote set in stone, but then you also have these kind of movable parts that's able to speak to our lives today? It's a paradox.
Right.
And I, you know, just thinking about Chesterton, one of my favorite quotes of his from Orthodoxy is, can the lion lay down with the lamb and still be fierce? And the answer is yes.
Right. Right.
You know, it's the paradox of the thing. It's Christianity is not a dead flat system. I think what does he say? It's this living house of paradoxes, right?
Yeah.
And that's what makes it beautiful.
Yeah. Or it's the line that Tumnus said to Lucy towards the beginning of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He was talking about Aslan. And Lucy said, well, is he safe?
Right.
And Mr. Tumnus says, no, he's not. Of course he's not safe. He's a lion.
Right.
But he's good.
But he's good.
We have an image in our mind. Well, to be good, you have to be safe.
Right.
And he's like, well, he's not safe, but he's good.
Yep.
And then if you have, I can't remember where I first heard this. I do know where I first heard this. It was in one of Rich Mullin's songs, the phrase, the hound of heaven.
Oh, yeah.
That God is the hound of heaven. He is not safe, but he will do anything to find us. He will
pursue
do anything
us.
To protect us, pursue us.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that's a line. I think C.S. Lewis maybe borrowed it from a poem as well, but I think that was made famous by Lewis in an essay of his just about the hound of heaven. And it is that idea of, you know, God is not this, you know, static thing that's saying, if you happen to fit into my box, then you're welcome. You know, God is like you just said, perfectly moving and pursuing and always trying to find us and reach out to us. And this goes back to the beginning of the encyclical, which was really beautiful. What is this all about? It's the incarnation, right? It's God, God coming down. You know, it's not us, you know, lifting ourselves up to heaven, but it's him becoming one of us and trying to speak to us in our day and age. And that's where the magisterium comes in and the social doctrine comes in. It's like, no, things haven't changed, but this is again, God reaching down and saying, this is how things should be. You know, this is what it means to be part of the kingdom of God. And that's what Pope Leo is getting to in this paragraph. And it's really beautiful. So good clarification, because development doesn't mean we're changing, and it doesn't mean
it's not flip-flopping.
It's not flip-flopping. Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And I think this lays out a great baseline for where we're going to look in the upcoming paragraphs. The church is always saying, and this I am always having to remind myself of this, God is in control. We live our lives so much of the time in a deistic framework that God is out there. We believe in God. He's out there. But for anything to happen, I have to do it, and I'm the sole responsibility of everything that happens around me, and creates so much anxiety and stress. But if you can live your life, it's not that you have to sit back, or not that you should sit back and do nothing and just wait for God to work. We have our responsibility. And that's, you know, you look at how God created us in the garden. He created us to do work, to have responsibility. But at the same time, we need to realize that we are not the ones that are ultimately in control of the world. God is the one that is in control. And so we can, as we'll be looking at the rest of this paragraph or even the rest of this chapter, we can work to care for the people around us because we know that God is ultimately in control. And one of the fears of helping people around you is, well, if I help people around me, I'm giving my stuff to them, then who is going to care for me?
Yeah. And self-preservation. Yeah.
Right. So let's jump into the next. We spent a lot of time with that first paragraph, but I think that was important because I think that really did lay a groundwork for what we're going to be looking at. But yeah, let's jump into paragraph 29. Why don't you read that, Lee?
Sure. Confronted with the new things of his time, the conflict between capital and labor, the question of the workforce, and economic and social transformations, Leo XIII did not limit himself merely to acknowledging the unrest, but saw these situations as an area for the church's pastoral mission. He exposed them to rigorous discernment, illuminating their causes and possible solutions in the light of the gospel and the integral vision of the human person created in the image of God.
Yeah, the first thing that popped into my head when I was reading this was, you know, the conflict between capital and labor, the question of the workforce, and economic and social transformations. And the first thing that popped in my mind was how much the world changed after the Industrial Revolution. It was night and day, as we've said. We said at the beginning, we couldn't even imagine what life was like before the Industrial Revolution because it was so, so different. When I was thinking about this last night preparing for our recording today, the first thing I thought of was, well, let's look at the numbers that of the cities, you know, the population of cities before and after the Industrial Revolution. And so I have these two charts, and we'll put them in the show notes. But the first one is looking at the population of cities before and after the Industrial Revolution within regions, so that the percentage of people that lived in cities. And in the year 1800, in North America, 6.6% of people lived in cities. In 1900, it was 33%. In 1950, it was 56%. And in 2000, it was 77.6%. So in the last 200 years, we've gone from, in North America, we've gone from 6.6% of people living in cities to over 3/4. And then if you look at the cities, and I have all the other regions here, and we'll share this chart with you, but the cities in 1800, London was 1 million people. In 1900, London was 6.6 million. New York was 60,000 in 1800, 3.4 million in 1900. Chicago was zero in 1800 because it wasn't incorporated until 1837. And then 1900, it was 1.7 million. So in 63 years, it went from zero to 1.7 million. Paris was 546,000 in 1800 and 2.7 million in 1900. And Berlin was 172,000 in 1800 and 1.9 million in 1900. And these were 1900 numbers. You know, the population of the world was so much smaller in 1900 than it was now.
Yeah.
You know, you look at cities now, you have Mexico City, I think, is around 34, 36 million, somewhere around there. It's insane how many people live in such confined areas today.
Well, how they migrated. It kind of makes me think, too, boy, especially that first one when you were talking about in the 1800s, it was like 6.6% of people lived outside of the cities. And in the year 2000, it was 77%. Yeah. Yeah. You know, think about where they came from. You know, it's not like these people just popped out of thin air. I mean, they were kind of migrating over to cities and then they had families and things like that. So think about, you know, we're here in the United States and you and I have both been to the West Coast and we've seen these ghost towns that are around, right? That just don't exist anymore. You know, you're driving through these areas and these cities don't exist. I think China has been having a pretty big issue with this now too. They've built these huge like mega metropolises with all of these, you know, different apartments and things for people and the industry will leave and these places are just ghost towns and they were built for, you know, almost a million people. It's just amazing the kind of what it does to the other side of things. I mean, think about what it did to the farmland, you know, think about what it did to the rural areas, having that mass exodus of people into the cities. And then we don't have to go too far down this today because this is a whole thing, but it's that whole idea of like, you know, it took 50 workers in a farm to do all of that work. And then they started migrating to the city, but the machinery helped. And now it only took two people at that farm to do that same amount of work that 50 people did. But now you don't have anything set up for that person who lives out in that rural area to be able to live a successful life. Right. I mean, it's just the spiral. And I think
what do we call it? We call it the industrial farming complex.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And you know, that's a really complex thing to kind of walk through as well. But that's what you're talking about. That's what Pope Leo XIII was seeing. And I think one of the most important lines in paragraph 29 there is how Pope Leo said he saw these situations as an area for the church's pastoral mission.
Yes. Yes.
Right? That is, you know, it's one thing to say, is Christianity a religion like Buddhism, right? Where it's kind of like, look, it's all up to us. If we reach nirvana, then all is well. And here's the church is saying, no, this is our pastoral mission. I think we talked about the whole, some of the parables in the Bible, like the Good Samaritan and things like that. It's like, you don't see that in other world religions,
right?
But you see it from Christianity of this is an opportunity to react pastorally to people, to bring them closer to Christ and not just watch the universe expand and this thing kind of explode.
Right.
You know, this is for the church to come in and say, okay, what can we do now? So,
yeah. One of the topics that I want to dive into more in the future, we don't have time for it today, but I think we talked about it a little bit when we had our two episodes on looking at AI and work. One of the things that I see that the Industrial Revolution did was it turned people into cogs.
Yeah.
And if you look at job satisfaction of most people today, it is so much lower than it was before the Industrial Revolution. Before the Industrial Revolution, you were trained in a skill, a craft, and you...
That was maybe passed down for generations, right?
Right.
I mean, you were...
Right, even from your parents.
Right.
Well, you look at people's names.
Right.
Smith.
Yep.
That's because you were a family of Smiths.
Yep.
You know, you worked in metal. And so we have lost so much purpose to our work that it is really hard. I mean, I feel so fortunate that I can come to work and spend as much time as I do doing work that is fulfilling. But I know that for so many people, they don't have that luxury.
Right.
They are... And we'll go into it later on in this episode, this idea of efficiency, as we've already talked about. But this idea of efficiency over everything else has stripped so much from our lives as productive people, as far as our purpose and meaning.
And we see that with young people today, because there's always the question of what's my contribution to society? And that's such a hard thing to pin down now, is what is your contribution? And I think that's why we're seeing so many people, you know, depressed, and so many people with anxiety, because we're working for, you know, I've been working for a living. I have all these country songs coming to my head all of a sudden when we're talking about that. But, you know, it's that whole idea of like, okay, how are you contributing to society? Why are you doing the work? Is there dignity in that work? Or are you doing it just to make money? You're on the treadmill and you can't wait till 5 o'clock and you go, you know, hang out with your friends afterwards and you're spending the money, right? It's this treadmill that you and I have been talking about for the last couple of weeks. And it's, I put a couple of notes in here on this kind of city development thing as well that we were talking about. I worked for public housing in New York City, which is one of the last public housing funded areas in the world. And, you know, they house more than the population of Miami. And it's pretty incredible when you talk about why they brought in public housing, even into the city of New York back in the early 1900s. It was kind of the late 1800s when they were deciding to do this, because of the population boom, all these people coming into the city to work for these factories and things like that. So housing, you know, I mean, the thing is these people weren't just moving to the cities and everything was set up for them and they're buying a nice house, you know, they're buying this nice apartment and they're ready to go. No, they're moving to the cities and there's no place for these people to live. There is no housing, you know, there's not enough food, there's not enough water, you know, now you're talking about having to build infrastructure and facilities like fire departments with the population of people. I mean, this is talk about a death spiral. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how it never stops. And what happens is it turns into a trap. You know, these people, they're looking for housing. Maybe they get some affordable housing. Now that rent goes up, now they need to make more money. You know, we talk a lot about the two income trap today. I think that was kind of big in the early 2000s, where we talk about, you know, can you even afford to live without the husband and wife both working and being away from home, and then childcare and that whole trap that people get in. Right. But back during the Industrial Revolution, that two income trap thing wasn't even a thing. It was called entire family labor. That's right. It was the whole family. I mean, you had not even teenagers working in factories, because families could not afford to live in these
working in the factories. Yeah,
that's right. Because they couldn't afford to live in these cities. And so they needed more children in order to have more workers to make more money. I mean, it was just unreal. So when you think about what the Industrial Revolution did to society, I mean, across the globe and to especially in the Western civilization, what it did to Western civilization is astronomical to think about. And I think it's really neat that Pope Leo XIV is setting this up, because he's saying, look at the astronomical changes that we saw because of the Industrial Revolution, and we're still seeing it today. And we're on the cusp right now of the same type of revolution. Shift, right? and is this a shift out of the cities back into the rural lands? I don't know. It's really interesting to think about.
Yeah. And I've traveled to a number of cities around the world where you see an even starker impact of the Industrial Revolution. You know, I think of, you know, in Bangkok, Mexico City, Lima, I've visited areas on the outskirts of the city. And if you think that, you know, public housing in New York is bad, you look at, you know, there's an area on the outskirts of Lima, because Lima is on the ocean, and there's a very small strip of land that is at sea level, and then you start going up into the mountains. And so on the edge of Lima, you have these hills, probably about, you know, 1,000, 1,500 feet tall, and they're just mounds. There's nothing on them. People just started to build up onto them. The city sees them as squatters because they're not paying for their land. But they have these small concrete block houses, very simple. You know, in Bangkok, the places with, you know, on the outside or right on the edge of the city, people have built these shacks out of whatever they can find. You know, none of these places have a sewage system or running water.
Right.
It's the same in cities all around the world. Places that don't have the regulation or the ability to enforce regulation that we have in the West, and people have just to survive have built these places so they can be near the work.
Boy, that's something to think about, isn't it? I mean, we've got these city planners that are able to step in, you know, these civil engineers that step in and say, this is what you would need for the expansion and growth, and they're able to pre-plan. And boy, I can see a correlation where, you know, in some areas of the world, you have some really good controls around AI, you know, saying here's how to build this thing and maybe put some guardrails on it. But what about other areas of the world that might not have that same level of planning, and what that's going to do to them and the exploitation of those people? And I think we get into that a little bit in paragraph 30, but just kind of thinking while you were making those comments about living, you know, how different that is. Boy, if they lived in a public housing apartment in New York City, they'd think they were the king.
Right.
You know, or just the difference, you know.
Thinking about the movie Coming to America.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. So
living, you know, in an apartment, this is great.
Yep.
I can go downstairs and get my hair cut.
Right.
This is
luxury.
Yes.
Right. But it's, boy, that's really interesting. I mean, it's all about kind of perspective and where you are, but just kind of having that thought process of what this is going to do to different areas of the world. And especially when we're seeing the exploitation of some of these other societies at the expense of some of these larger organizations, you know, feeding the LLMs and trying to train them. And we know that, you know, they're kind of exploiting some people in third world countries. So something to think about for sure.
Well, and that brings us into paragraph 30. The document places the dignity of work and of workers at the forefront of its reflection, affirms the right to a fair wage for oneself and one's family, recognizes that persons have a fundamental value that takes precedence over capital and profit, defends private property along with its indispensable societal role, esteems workers' associations, and proposes forms of cooperation between the different components of society as an alternative to the mentality of class struggle.
Yeah, so here we see, you know, the middle class wasn't something that happened directly after the Industrial Revolution, but it's this idea that the more you make, the more you spend, and sort of that trap. I love that line, defends private property along with its indispensable societal role. Think about how many people we know, you know, move to the city and they're renting an apartment, they're renting their cars, they're renting, I mean, everything they have, they don't own a single thing.
Right.
Nothing to their name, right? I mean, we've got some, you know, if you're renting, of course, you have some, there's some pretty decent laws out there that protect your status for living and things like that. But still, I mean, even so, you know, if you were to lose your job, you have nothing to your name.
Yes.
And that's where cities run into really big sort of problems with homelessness and things like that. Look, if your farm's not producing crops, that's an issue. You go out and you work even harder and you know, borrow from your neighbor, or the community would come together and they would help each other survive. And because of this sort of singularity of the middle class and, you know, just all in it for themselves, and you don't have this societal role, this indispensable societal role of private property anymore. I mean, Seth, if you've got private property, if you've got a house and you own it, and, you know, my crops aren't growing and I need some money, you're like, well, I mean, here I've got, look at my storehouse. I've got things that you can borrow, right? We're able to interact off of each other.
I can help with you now because I know that in a few years, you're going to need my help.
Right.
I'm going to need your help. You know, there's a give and take. And if you're in a community like that, there's no question.
Right.
You know, you think about you look at the image of, you know, and I went to college in Pennsylvania. And so I was very close to one of the larger Amish communities. You see a community coming together to build a barn raising.
Yep.
It's like, well, this family needs a barn. Let's all get together on Saturday. We're going to build a barn for them.
Right. And so this is where doctrine has shifted a little bit. Well, not shifted in a bad way, but it's grown and expanded for the church because it's saying, okay, we're all moving to the city. Yes. So instead of this yes. sort of communal aspect of society, then what are we looking for? Well, how about just fair wages so yeah. people can support themselves and their families, recognizing that, you know, these people have fundamental value over capital and profit. And actually, you know, Pope Leo XIII goes into it in Rerum Novarum, but you could almost read that as capital as, you know, a different way of capitalism, right? And so does the fundamental value of a person take precedence over capitalism and profit? Or is it the businesses that we're giving precedence to? And that's a really big part of this as well.
Yeah, and you look at this, just these few paragraphs that we read in the sentences that we read in paragraph 30. And this is a good summary of Rerum Novarum that it was both critical of capitalism and of communism.
Right.
It, because both of those are looking at the bigger picture.
Right.
And this is saying, no, we need to care for the individual person, for the individual family.
Right.
We need to be sure that each person is taken care of, not the overall system.
Well, that's such an important point. It's not the church isn't saying, no, we need to go backwards. We need to go back to the farmland. We need to go back to this rural, you know, agrarian type of society. That's not the position the church is taking. The position the church is taking is, well, this is the case. If we're all moving to cities, here's how we need to set this up to make sure that we're not losing the dignity of a human being in the incarnation of Christ and living out our gospel mission pastorally, right? That's what they're saying. Right. That's the development. Now, this would read very differently, and we've talked about this for the last couple of weeks, if Pope Leo XIV were to say, AI is evil, stop using it.
Yes.
And that's not the case. It's, we know that something's going to change. How do we make sure that we're looking after our fellow man still, even in the in the positions we're living in? And there's a second part to paragraph 30. Do we want to talk about that a little bit too?
Yeah, why don't you read that next section of paragraph 30?
Okay, great. While many of the historical conditions described by Leo XIII have changed, at least two insights remain highly relevant today. The primacy of human labor over any mindset focused solely on finance or productivity, with the consequent attention to the people and the families most susceptible to exploitation, and the inseparable link between proclaiming the gospel and pursuing a more just social order. I mean, that says it right there.
Yeah.
You know, there's two insights that we need to glean off of. We're talking industrial revolution. Now we're talking this AI revolution. What are the two things we need to focus on? The primacy of human labor over finance or productivity. That one hit me hard when I read that. I mean, what's the reason why a lot of us are using AI is we're thinking, well, we're so sick of this kind of knowledge worker age where we're sitting in our email all day and just, you know, working on things that we think don't matter. And we're thinking AI is going to be just the savior of that and make us more productive.
Right.
And, you know, what does more productive mean, and productive for what? And yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about. Everything attached to AI has, you know, there's two things related to it: money and efficiency.
Right.
And those are the two things that Pope Leo is calling out, saying we need to be careful.
Yeah, and this focus on efficiency,
it's
been around for so long that we don't even question it.
Right.
Of course, we think, well, of course we need to be more efficient, but if you stop and you think, well, why? Why do we have to be more efficient? Do we have to be more efficient just so we can make more things so that we can be more efficient? It's cyclical.
Right.
And it takes so much, as we've saying earlier, it takes so much of the meaning and the purpose out of the work that we do if the only purpose is to become more efficient.
Yeah.
Well, why are you doing it? Why are you being more efficient? Well, because I have to be. Because, as we were saying before, you look at the role of the work that an individual does since the Industrial Revolution, all the way from the factories, people standing in front of a machine, pulling a lever, pushing a button, doing something, a repetitive task physically, to sitting in a cubicle, looking over a spreadsheet, writing a report. I think of the movie Office Space, the focus of the TPS report in Office Space. And then you get to the conversations like, well, we can spend an hour in a meeting at work talking about the font size in the report. Well, who cares? But it's not efficient enough.
Right. Well, and this kind of makes me think, too, of a lot of friends that you and I have in the tech industry, and just a lot of the stress and anxiety they have right now of being laid off and things because of the efficiency of AI. And so what's happening is these people are at a frantic pace trying to learn AI, trying to build models for themselves, trying to do more work than they've ever done. So you have these individuals that are working longer hours than they ever have, doing more work than they've ever done because of AI. And they're even trying to, help train different models and things like that. But, this is exactly what Popelio is speaking against, is we've just exploited that person. And that's become, in your words, Seth, a human cog in the machine of AI. So now you've got one worker that's working double time because he's got fear that he's going to lose his job to a machine. So that's the definition of exploitation. You're laying off all of these people at organizations, but keeping one or two and saying, well, you've got to double it up. And I think we talked about this maybe several weeks ago in one of the podcasts with you and Cesar, but it was a lot of the friends that I've talked to is that, well, I'm not getting any more work done. I'm actually spending more time trying to train this dumb AI model than I was, a couple of years ago actually getting work done. It's bizarre.
Or thinking about the AI models that write code.
Right.
They're spending more time debugging the code.
Yep.
And making sure that it works well instead of just writing it themselves.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I had a conversation with someone who worked with Google who happens to go to my parish, and he was part of the AI development team for Gemini and things like that. And one of his comments that he made to me is, he's kind of pseudo-retired right now, and he's pretty young like us. And it's like, oh, what happened? And he's like, well, I built myself out of a job.
Right.
I was doing such a good job training these models for AI. They looked at me and said, hey, we actually don't even need you anymore. So what's interesting about this is people are working overtime to produce more because they fear that they're going to lose their jobs, when in the end, that's probably what's going to happen.
They're training the machine that's going to take their job.
Right. It's, exploitation at its finest. And I think that's
And think about what that means to the person doing that.
Right.
What does that mean for your value?
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about purpose, but what about the value of the individual? And not just kind of this religious amorphous, well, you're all, everyone's valuable. But when you're at work, what keeps you from going home at the end of the day saying, I did something good today, versus I just spent all day doing something and I'm exhausted and I don't feel any better than I did. I feel worse because I've spent all this time trudging through this work that has no meaning.
Right.
And then thinking about that, what you're just saying, if you're spending your entire day working harder than you ever had before to train an AI model because that's what you're supposed to do, and having that thought in the back of your head, well, I could be training the AI model that is going to replace me, and then I will not have any work.
Right. And he says it at sort of the beginning of that second part of paragraph 30, the two insights, really the first one, the primacy of human labor, and what does that mean? And it's this idea that we should be careful not to build human labor out of work, because that should always take primacy over anything else that we're doing, is not separating humans from the thing. And I think we're seeing a little bit of a shift. I see online all the time now when I'm looking at something to order, it's like touched by human hands or made by humans. And you're like, oh, thanks for the clarification. That's sort of a remnant of the Industrial Revolution. I think we're going to start seeing that a lot on the AI side of things, where people are now tagging, is this written by AI or is this not written by AI? Is this 100% a human that did this thing? Yes. And does that add some sort of value, that it was done by a human and not an AI model? That'd be something interesting to sort of dive into as well.
Well, and I want to take a moment here to guarantee that our scripts are not written by AI. Our episodes would be a lot shorter and more efficient if that were the case.
But the irony of that, it's true. I wanted to write a shorter letter, but I didn't have time, is kind of the famous quip for an English major. But it's true. You know, if we were doing this with AI, if the name of the game was efficiency, hey, log in and find out everything you want to about this new encyclical, well, you know, there you have it. But
there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and this thought just popped in my head, proves this is not written by AI. But you think about the last 75 years, say, I'm not sure the exact time frame, but the growth in America of the hobbies. People have hobbies because they want to do something that is meaningful. If you're going to work and you don't feel any fulfillment from the work you're doing at your job, but you still have a desire to be productive in a meaningful way, well, what are you going to do? You're going to find something to do in your spare time that gives you purpose and meaning. Right. And so you get a hobby.
Well, because that intrinsically, you know, it's something that you own, right? Because it's something that you have that you can care after. You're not working for an organization that maybe doesn't have the same values as you. And you know, hobbies are a great way of separating yourself from that a little bit. And I think this all kind of comes back to this idea of private property and ownership. You know, even in the worst conditions, you know, people working in a coal mine, and we could fill this entire episode with a bunch of songs related to work, but just how you kind of separate from
just,
that.
Just make a country song playlist to go along with.
Right, exactly. Just make notes. A playlist about, you know, to go along with the encyclical. But it's this, you know, you leave work and it's the only thing you really have to your name is, well, I'm really good at this. Like, this is my hobby that I'm really good at. Yeah, I work for, you know, I work for
nine
a living.
To five.
Right. But this is the one thing you can attach to your name that's like, what, but who am I? Well, I'm a musician, you know, and I'm really good, you know, playing music, and that's my hobby, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. And that's something that's been trained over years and years and years. And that I think that's a ramification of the Industrial Revolution, is if everyone's moving to the cities and working in factories and they're just a cog in the system, what makes them human, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to some of the popes after Pope Leo XIII. So paragraph 31 says, Pius XI's encyclical Quadragesimo Anno was published in 1931 on the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum at the height of a major global economic crisis, marking a further step in the Church's social teaching. Rather than limiting itself to addressing the workforce question, it broadened its focus to encompass the overall structure of the economic and political order. So as we were saying before, Rerum Novarum focused mainly on the industrial side, you know, the role of the worker, the role of industry. And Pope Pius XI, he wrote this with a broader look at, well, what does it mean for society? And what does it mean for the whole political order?
Well, right. And what we have to remember with Quadragesimo Anno is that, you know, this was written like during the Great Depression.
Right.
So, you know, we've got Rerum Novarum that's kind of setting this whole thing up, and Pope Leo XIII that's prophetic, you know, in what he's saying is going to happen with the Industrial Revolution. And then 40 years after that, we have Pius XI saying, well, Here's what happens.
Yes.
you've got wealth inequality, which is a big part of Quadragesimo Anno, and you've got totalitarianism. It's a pretty heavy hitting one.
Yeah, and you look at, you know, in America, at least you had the Dust Bowl that led up to it. And the Dust Bowl was the impact of industrial scale farming.
Right. Right. Yes,
so
exactly.
On so many levels, you have this very serious impact of the Industrial Revolution just 40 years later.
Right. Well, I mean, look at the title, Quadragesimo Anno. I mean, in the 40th year. So basically, Pope Pius XI is saying, so we're in the 40th year of this complete change to our society, and I'd like to tell you all what's been happening so far.
It sucks.
It's really, really bad. And we need to find a way out of this because it caused this Great Depression and there's a bunch of fallout now. And what are we supposed to do? Again, Pope Pius XI was taking this pastoral mission approach for the church of saying, yeah. Okay, here's where we find ourselves. Now, what is the church's position to help care for these people? You know, care for the people that are exploited the most because of wealth inequality and totalitarianism. This encyclical really does set up this idea of we have a huge gap. We have the people that are doing the work versus the people that are making mega, mega amounts of money. And we've got a whole lot of space in between. And that sets up, the perfect storm for totalitarianism, fascism, you name it. Again, this was published in 1931. And we basically saw, we were in between a couple of world wars because of the Industrial Revolution, because of how societies were being set up. It's tough to tell, but there were a lot of different factors in play. But I think this is a brilliant one that people should take the time to read as well. Not quite as long as Rerum Novarum, but it's a good one.
And it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing now because, the Industrial Revolution was almost 150 years ago. But it's not a new thing as far as humanity. This has always been our struggle as humanity, is the search for power, the search for wealth, the hoarding of power and wealth in the few on the top, and the impact that it has on the people who are just trying to live their lives. You think about every single war that has ever happened. What is the structure of war? It is someone on the top that decides that we want some resource that someone else has. So we are going to go out and take it. And how do we do that? We conscript a whole bunch of people that are under us and say, okay, go fight this war. And so the spoils, if there are any, go to people under the top. And the people that are impacted the most are the people that are conscripted to go and fight and don't see anything good that might possibly come from that war.
Right.
And so whether it's on a political side of an actual war, or we hear in economic warfare, or even the AI arms race, so much in the economic realm is talked about as if it were a war. And it's the same thing. Who gets anything good from it, if anything good does come from it, and who pays the biggest price for it?
Yeah. I mean, we probably don't have time to go into it today, but just what happened after World War II, even in the society of the United States, and how people started going back to the land, back to the farms, back to private ownership. It really was this kind of great reset that happened where the values of the family came into play. And so you've got this huge period of time where that two income trap that we were talking about, or the family trap that we were talking about, of all the kids and family, that kind of went away, and then it became single income families again. And it became this kind of plutonic thing that we see a lot of times in movies and cartoons and things like that. And then there was another shift that happened in society. So it's pretty interesting that Pius XI, his point was not, again, to sort of point out, here's the direction that we need to go. I think that was Pope Leo XIII that was really trying to tell us, hey, be careful, this is what's going to happen. Right. I think Pius XI was saying, again, this is the fallout, and this is how to manage the fallout. Yeah.
Right. Well, why don't you go on and read paragraph 33
then? Sure. So paragraph 33, a new phase in the church's social teaching began with St. John the 23rd, who placed a greater emphasis on the global dimension of social issues and the language of rights. In Mater et Magistra, he presented the Christian faith as a light capable of uniting heaven and earth. He recalled that while the church's primary mission is the sanctification and proclamation of eternal goods, she does not neglect the concrete needs of people's daily lives and is concerned with every authentic human good.
Yeah, it's a greater development of this idea of, I love that last phrase, every authentic human good, which goes against, in many ways, the whole ideal of efficiency.
Right.
If you are looking for the good of each person, then you're necessarily not being efficient because you want everyone to live up to their potential. If you're looking to be the most efficient, you would say to someone, well, I don't think you should focus on that because we already have someone doing it.
Right.
And to have two people doing that, that's not efficient.
Right. And what's interesting about St. John's 23rd's position, and what's interesting about these two paragraphs, is the amount of time that's being jumped, kind of the time right. jump, you know, that's happening here. We've gotten, you know, 1930s, and we fast forward now to St. Pope 60s. John the 23rd. Yeah, in the 60s, exactly, which is what I was going to mention, that whole kind of change that we saw after World War II as a society in the United States. And now St. Pope John the 23rd is coming in, and he's saying, oh, by the way, like, the whole point of life is not to just escape life, but the whole point right. of life is to sanctify life. And it's I love how he says that whole, the Christian faith is a light capable of uniting heaven and earth. It's like, well, wait a second. I thought the whole point was, you know, earth is a catastrophe. Like this world war we just got out of, and now we're in the 60s.
We have to escape it.
Yeah, we need to escape it, right? And he's saying, no, our primary mission is to sanctify it. You know, is to sanctify the world and not neglect people in their lives and look at, like you just said, every authentic human good. And so now we're seeing a shift again with these encyclicals. And again, this development of Christian doctrine, just to go back to the beginning of what we were talking about, you can see that the church isn't changing its position. It is still focused on what it's always been focused on, its primary mission, right? It's always the sanctification and the proclamation of eternal goods, you know, storing up your treasures in heaven. But at the same time, it's uniting heaven and earth. It's that whole incarnate sort of thing that Pope Leo XIII was talking about. So nothing's changing, but you can see that these are huge generational gaps and how the popes have each come out to speak differently, but the same, you know, sort of the same underlying tones, but in a different way to match society.
Yeah. Well, and the picture that I had then thinking about Pope John the 23rd writing in the 60s, this is going to sound odd when I first say it, but disco. And you think about disco as an escapism. I can't deal with life right now in this industrial world of I just have to go and do my work. And as I said before, working 9 to 5, then I think that came out in the 60s, maybe 70s. But I'm working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Yeah. And I need to do something to escape that. And that is, I think that's one of the impacts of the Industrial Revolution, is that has led to, and it has just gotten worse since the 60s.
Right.
You know, this escapism. I need, you know, and even thinking, we've talked before about, you know, Ready Player One, the ultimate escapism. I can't deal with the fact that I'm living in this mobile home that is in a stack of mobile homes 20, 30 high. I can't deal with the meaningless of the life that I'm living in the real world, so I'm going to escape into a virtual world. And that it's the same thing that's happening with AI. So many people, and you talked about the depression and anxiety, the number of people that are going to AI for emotional support and escaping the world around them into a virtual world, whether it is actual VR or video games or artificial intelligence, it is I want to at least pretend that life can be better.
That's an interesting topic too, this whole idea of AI. My kids and I were playing around one day with Grok, Seth, and you know, you can turn on the sort of the therapist version. And so every question we asked was like, you know, hey, what is the difference between like a desert tortoise and a turtle? You know, and it would tell you, and it's like, why do you have a problem with turtles? Did you want to talk more about your issue with turtles? which is hilarious. But you know, the thing is, I guess it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, it's almost to us, you know, we laugh at it and it just seems absolutely absurd. You know, my kids are just laughing at it too. But for a lot of people, that may be one of the only interactions they're able to get ever,
right?
You know, right. And so what does that mean for us as Catholics who are helping construct these maybe AI models and or at least tools to help people that are searching for help in the tool, but to give them a better answer than what society's feeding them today in the LLMs? I don't know. Just right. The thought I had there is it an opportunity for us, you know, to instead of saying, oh, that's ridiculous, we shouldn't be using it that way, it's, well, maybe it's legit. Maybe they do need somebody to talk to. And can we point them to, you know, a better place? But right now those models are hilarious and they're not ready for, you know, prime time. But it does speak to the human psyche. You know, we've got a lot of apathy running around, especially from the 60s. It's kind of this give up mentality of, oh, I'm just going to give up. Like the world is just, you know, it's on a trajectory of collision and I'm just going to live my life to the fullest and be done with it. But then now we're seeing
it's the ultimate, you know, eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we die.
Yep. Yep. And that's right. But now we're seeing this sort of, eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we'll die. But at the same time, you know, Grok, can we talk? Because I really want to find out what the point of being a human is. So you could tell, like, it's just we have as humans this desire, right? And that's where the church, I think, can hopefully in these times of AI reach out and say, look, that's God knocking on your door, you know, and what can we do to sort of help guide people in the right way? And until then, just ask it questions about turtles and it's really fun.
Well, and to go back to the end of paragraph, what we read in paragraph 33, the church's primary mission, she does not neglect the concrete needs of people's daily lives and is concerned with every authentic human good. So the church is concerned about every aspect of a person's life. And it's not just the person's spiritual situation, it's their emotional situation, it's their mental situation, their physical situation. The church is concerned about each individual completely, because God is concerned about each individual completely.
Well, and look at the verbiage that's used there. It's not, we're concerned about society and where it's going, so in the next 100 years, we're setting things up for future generations. It says the concrete needs of people's daily lives.
Right. Yep.
And
you think about one of the big prayers of the church. Give us this day our daily bread.
Right. Right.
You know, God is always concerned about each one. Like, everyone that's listening to this, God is concerned about every moment of your life, every aspect of your life. And so God does not look at you like a cog in the machine. God does not look at you as a small part of this greater mission that has to be done to save the entire world. No, God is concerned for you.
Right.
And for your good. And for your happiness, and not just some great spiritual good that you can do, but God is concerned for your joy, your peace. God wants each one of us to have peace of mind. Imagine God sitting looking at us all in all of our deep anxiety. And, you know, he says, well, you know, Jesus, my son, he came to earth and he said, do not worry about what you wear or what you do or what you eat. God doesn't want us to worry about anything. He wants us to care for ourselves and care for each other and not fall into this trap of this meaningless life all concentrated on efficiency.
Right. Or keeping up with the Joneses, right? Yeah. Because I think that's a big difference too, is give us this day our daily bread as long as it's what I like to eat. You know, and I think we need
as
to be careful.
As long as it's not peas.
Right. You know, it's just that idea of totally giving up to self. And the other thought I had when we were talking about this is just, again, another introduction to paradox, because here you and I are talking about how, well, the church has just said that we should be caring about people's daily lives and that God cares about our daily lives. But just a few paragraphs above, we were saying, well, no, God cares about where society is moving. Well, how could it be both? And it's like, yes, that's right. It's both. That's the paradox. We're concerned about the individual and we're concerned about society. It's both.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and the church is concerned with society because it impacts the individual life.
The individual. That's right.
You know, you can't say, well, the church is just going to care for all the people down here and not say anything about society or industry in general.
No, because that's escapism, right? And that's not something that the church does, right?
Right. And if that were the case, then the church would be, which I think a lot of people have this picture of the church would be, okay, we're just going to be here feeding the poor, giving a place for people to sleep. We're going to care for everyone that you're throwing away. And we're just going to let you keep throwing them away.
Right.
And we'll take care of them. It's like, no, the church is saying, we're here to care for the poor. But we really would like there to be no poor.
Right. We can also make life better. There's a way to do that.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Let's jump into this last paragraph that we have for this episode. Paragraph 35. During the pontificate of St. Paul VI, an understanding of peace emerged that was not reduced to the mere absence of war, but took shape within the scope of integral human development. In Populorum Progressio, he described development as a transition from less humane to more humane living conditions. He further understood it as a process that concerns each person and the whole person.
Hmm.
I mean, that's what we were just talking about. The church is concerned not just for each person, but for the whole person.
Right. So we slowed way down, you know, jumping into St. Pope Paul the sixth here. You know, we kind of made a jump from the 30s to the 60s, and now we slowed way down, and we're still in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know,
A
lot happened, right. Well, and that's, I think that's the point, is the church has given guidance in those times of most need. You know, we were seeing this whole, well, peace means no war, and St. Pope Paul the sixth was saying, no, peace means, you know, so much more than the lack of war. It also means, you know, what are we doing for humanity? Look at people's living conditions. Look at, you know, where they're finding themselves. I mean, these are maybe things that a lot of people in the 60s weren't even necessarily thinking about. They had kind of the big rocks in front of them they were trying to move at the expense of the individual person. So again, it's always this call for the individual and being sure that we're not exploiting or leaving anyone behind.
Right. Well, and we have Pope John the 23rd and Pope Paul the 6th are the beginning and the end of the Second Vatican Council. And that played a huge role in the life of the church since then.
Right.
I mean, that's whether people like it or people hate it, people are still talking about the impact of the Second Vatican Council on individuals, on the church, and on the world.
Yeah. Well, because of its, you know, its position on sanctification of the world, you know, we've moved from, you know, the late 1800s, where we've got Pope Leo the 13th, who was, you know, locked up in the Vatican when he wrote Rerum Novarum, you know, and didn't have a lot of, you know, didn't have a lot of opportunity to speak to the world at large, you know, but was speaking to Catholics. And fast forward to St. Pope Paul VI, who's speaking to now the world. Pope John the 23rd, St. Pope Paul VI are both, you know, the bookends to Vatican II. And now they're saying, no, this is for everyone. This isn't just for Catholics. This isn't just for us in Italy. This isn't just for the Western civilization. This is for everyone. Yeah.
Well, and as we said, I think it was last episode, it was St. Pope John the 23rd that first used the phrase, all men of goodwill.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
That this is, we need to take a wider view of the world and the role of everyone in the world, not just Catholics, but looking back at all of the councils of the church, looking at the Council of Trent, it was the first church council that happened after the Reformation. And it was the first time that there was a church council that happened where there were people that were had split from and left the Catholic Church, but were still following Jesus in a way that was mainly or mostly in line with what the church taught. Every church council before that, you look at the Arianism or modalism, all these heresies that had happened before that, it was all these questions of, mainly centered around the person of Christ or the divinity of Christ. And it was introducing some teaching that was so far off that the church had to say, no, that is wrong. That is not who Jesus is. We need to clarify who we say God is, who we say the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is. And so you have this broadening. The church is going from Trent all the way through the Second Vatican Council, broadening its view of who can we see as, people that we are walking alongside. The church says that Protestants are our separated brethren. They're not in full communion with the church, but we acknowledge that, and we know this experience from our own lives, in the churches that we went to before we became Catholic, that, we still look at that time before we became Catholic and it's like, well, yeah, I was following God. I was following Jesus.
Right.
As best as I understood it. And right. I don't look at that time and say, well, I was completely wrong and I'm glad I became Catholic because I was a heretic back then. And so this broadening of the view that the church is taking of the world, saying, we have to work together. And anyone that is, as we said, I think it was last week, anyone who is seeking the good, the true, and the beautiful, they are seeking God because God is the good, the true, and the beautiful. And we can work with them. And it does not keep us from wanting to call them home to the Catholic Church.
Right.
But at the same time, we can say, no, I see that we are on the same page with so many things.
Right.
And so with this look at AI, it is so important that we work together with anyone that is seeking the same goal as we are.
Right. Because in the end, if people are looking after human dignity, they're looking after humanity, they're looking after the primacy of human labor, which I think a lot of people now, Anthropic came out with this, great letter just a couple of weeks ago that was talking about, the benefits of AI. I think we read some of it last time as well. And just that idea of, if everyone had access to this, there'd be opportunities, in the medical sphere, and opportunities in technology to help better people's lives. Okay, we're with that. I mean, if it's an opportunity to better people's lives, that's an opportunity for us as Catholics to look at something like that and say, yeah, that's what we mean. We can't forget the human impact of these things. And I think there's some organizations out there that are starting to realize that, like, hey, slow down a little bit because we may be impacting society in a way that we can't reverse very quickly, and we need to make sure that we're building things. We need to make sure that we're building the city. We're mixing metaphors here, but building the city the right way for the people that are going to be, migrating to the city from the country, right?
Right.
Not to say that if you don't use AI, you're not in the country. If you're in the country versus people that use AI in the city, not as a negative way, but if they're migrating,
you're a yokel bumpkin.
Right.
Well, and as we've talked about, you look at the long-term impact of the Industrial Revolution, that we're still feeling impact and changes of something that happened 150 years ago.
Yep.
And so Well, of course, we need to look at AI not just as what it is doing now and not just what it promises to do in the next 5 years. What will be the impact 50 years or 100 years from now?
Right. You
know, as we've said, the impact of the purpose of an individual that has come into our world because of the Industrial Revolution is it took almost 100 years to really feel the impact of that. And it's just getting worse every day. And so what is going to be the long-term effect of AI in our world? And the church is one of the best institutions to be able to look at that because the church has the perspective of 2,000 years of human development, of the change in society. The church has walked, as we've used that language last time, walked alongside of human society.
Right.
And so the church has a perspective that countries don't have, that corporations definitely don't have, and that individuals can't have, of this long view of human history.
Right. Right. And to kind of go back to that metaphor that Pope Leo XIV used at the beginning of this encyclical, you know, just what are we trying to build? Are we in it for ourselves and we're building the Tower of Babel, or are we talking about building a better society in the walls around Jerusalem? Yeah. And I think that's always good to keep in mind as you're reading through this encyclical, because it's like, oh yeah, the point of this is not to create our own God, you know, and not to make ourselves gods, but it's to better society and not ever forget, you know, the gospel message that God is trying to bring down to us through his son, Jesus. And that's where Christian doctrine develops. You know, you just mentioned societal developments, and that's where the development of Christian doctrine is not a change in Christian doctrine, but it's how Christ is speaking to us today through these things that we're seeing. And that's a powerful way to look at it, because we can always think, well, how is Christ speaking to us through, you know, with the shift with AI, you know, and it's something that we should all be thinking about as Christians, I think, is does that take away from, or does that help our neighbor? And if it doesn't line up with the gospel message, then it's not the right thing.
Right. Well, this has been a really great look. And as I said at the beginning, this is only from Pope Leo XIII through Pope Paul VI in the 60s. And so next week, we're going to continue with this look at this overview of the development of the social doctrine of the church from Rerum Novarum to today. And so we'll be looking at what has happened in the church from the 60s to Pope Leo XIII. And so I think that we're going to continue this kind of what we've been looking at as far as the development of the world and how the church sees individuals and how the church has worked to care for the individuals in our society today. So I want to encourage you to come back next time and join us as we continue to dive into Magnifica Humanitas. I want to remind you, though, if you go over to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for our email list and get updates when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up recently, and any financial support you can give would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. Lee, thank you again for another awesome deep dive.
Yeah, and thank you, Seth. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nerdy deep dive.
Absolutely, my pleasure. It was great.
Talk to you next time.
All right, see you guys.
system shut down.